I invite you to open your Bibles this evening to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. A couple of weeks ago, and following, seeking to follow the His Word study and reading through the New Testament, and looking at Matthew 21 through 25, I was looking for a possible text to study with you. And I said, well, why not Matthew 24? There's a lot of differing understandings of this passage. Perhaps this would be a good opportunity for us to look at it together. I should have known better than to try to cover that in one message. So this is part two, but I got to do a little review. But I want to approach the study with this question: do the signs indicate that the end of the world is near? Because many would answer that question, yes, but the way that they would identify the signs is some of the language found in this very chapter, Matthew chapter 24. So I ask us, let's go into this text, and I'm going to get a little historical with you, and look at Jesus' statements in light of history and some things that I think he was pointing to. And so it's a challenging study, but I hope that we'll be able to understand what the questions that Jesus was answering on this occasion. The occasion is of utmost importance. Let's look at verse 1 together. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say to you, not one stone shall be left here upon another that shall not be thrown down." The temple that the disciples are pointing to is Herod's temple. And so Jesus is looking at this very structure, these buildings that compose Herod's temple. And he's predicting to them that there's not one stone of this magnificent structure that'll be left one on top of the other. So this was going to be a terrible destruction that would come upon Jerusalem, and the temple itself would be destroyed. And this was fulfilled in AD 70, 40 years from the time Jesus spoke these words. The Roman general Titus led the Roman army, and they destroyed Jerusalem. And just as Jesus had predicted, the stones of this temple were just cast down on the valley surrounding it, fulfilling Jesus' prophecy. Well, Jesus is telling the disciples, this is what's going to happen. And so they have some questions. Look at verse 3 with me. As he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" So when is this going to happen, Jesus? And what will be the sign that all these things are about to happen? And I think it's very possible that the disciples are asking these questions with something in their mind, and particularly about the end of the age and the sign of Jesus coming. Perhaps even assuming that Jesus talking about this temple being utterly destroyed, that must be the end of the world. And so they're probably thinking, when is this going to happen, Jesus? And what will be the sign that it's about to happen? I'm going to focus more upon Jesus' answer to their questions than what was in their mind asking those questions. But notice that they are asking, when will these things be? And what signs would tell them that these things are about to happen? Let me jump ahead to verse 34, and we're reviewing. Verse 34 is a very critical boundary line. Jesus makes this statement, "Assuredly I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." And I want to ask again tonight, as I did last Sunday night, what does this generation refer to? And the answer, obviously, is the generation of those to whom Jesus was speaking on that occasion. So he's setting a time limit here, a boundary. "I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." That's in verse 34. If that is correct, then everything that precedes verse 34, all the way through from verse 1 to verse 34, must be included in these things that would take place in that generation. And that's crucial because that helps us understand more about what Jesus is saying in these verses. So the disciples have asked these questions, and we see later on that he's giving a boundary line, that all these things would happen in this generation. But then Jesus talks about some misleading and preliminary signs. I don't even know if I should use the word signs in referring to these things. But look at verse 4 with me. Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you." So before he talks about a sign that by which they could tell that these things were about to happen, he says, "Beware lest you be deceived. Watch out that no one deceives you." Again, continuing the reading in verse 5. "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." As you keep reading, you'll see that Jesus talks about earthquakes and other things. And many will take Jesus' words here and apply them and look at what's going on in the world today. And they'll say, "See, there's wars, there's rumors of wars, there's an earthquake, and there's a pestilence over here." And all the signs are pointing to the fact that Jesus is about to return. You see, what they're doing is they're taking Jesus' words spoken, Matthew 24, first century, about AD 30, and taking them out of their context and saying, "Look, the signs are pointing to the end of the world." Let's put them back in their context. Jesus is saying, "Don't be deceived. Watch out. You're going to hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." And so really, he's saying, don't take these things as signs that the end of Jerusalem is close at hand. And again, he lists, and we're not going to take the time to read verses 7 through 14, but he gives some other things, some other possibly misleading events by which the disciples would say, "Well, the time must be near because this is happening." This is where we left off last Sunday. Jesus does, in fact, give a real sign. Verse 15. "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place," the temple, "whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." The things that he's talked about beforehand, he's saying, don't be deceived into thinking that these are signs that the end is about to come. These are all preliminary. There will be wars and rumors of wars, earthquakes, pestilences, but the end is not yet. But you can know that the end is near when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet. That's where we left off last week. And I said, that's the sign, the abomination of desolation. Anastasia Overton came to me after worship last Sunday night, said, "We're going to be out of town next week. You got to tell me, what is the abomination of desolation?" I said, "Well, you'll have to get it next week. And then I told him, "Well, it has to do something with an army. Does that help anything?" And I don't think she was satisfied with that. But we see Jesus is pointing back to Daniel the prophet. And that takes us to Daniel chapter 9. And let me summarize some things we find in that text. It's a text about 70 weeks, which most agree to be a figurative way of expressing a time of approximately 490 years. According to Daniel's prophecy, the Messiah will come after the 69th week. Thus, the last week or the last 7-year period shall see the coming of the Anointed One, the Prince, the Messiah. And that's something that the Jews were looking for, the coming of the Messiah. And that's something that the Old Testament prophets, including Daniel, foretold. During this final week, Daniel says in this prophecy, the anointed one shall be cut off and shall have nothing. That has to be a reference to Jesus being crucified on the cross. But then, according to Daniel 9, another prince shall come whose people will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And there is a reference to Jerusalem and to the sanctuary, the temple. This prince, this ruler will come whose people will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And in chapter 9, verse 27 of Daniel, this prince who shall come to destroy the city and the sanctuary or the temple is said to come on a wing of abominations to make his desolation. So Jesus has taken that Old Testament prophecy and said, here is the sign. Here is what you can watch for to know that the end is about to occur. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. It still begs the question, doesn't it? What? Anastasia had a great question. What is the abomination of desolation? This is when it's helpful for us to look at the other gospel accounts. And I want to point you to Luke chapter 21, verse 20. It's a parallel text. And notice what Jesus says. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. You see, that explains more about what this abomination of desolation, what it would involve. Jesus, in Luke's account, says, when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that that desolation that was foretold by Daniel is near. We've already said that in AD 70, Jerusalem and the temple were destroyed. History also tells us that that Roman army marched on Jerusalem after a siege of 134 days designed to weaken resistance. The Roman army broke through the walls, destroyed the city, and burned the temple. So they surrounded that city. There was a siege that lasted 134 days. And so when those believers would see those armies, they had heard of wars. They'd heard of rumors of wars. They'd heard of earthquakes and all these other things. But they had been told by Jesus, that's not the end. But when you see the armies surrounding Jerusalem, then you'll know that that desolation is near. And those who heard his words and grasped them and acted upon them knew that was the sign. When those Roman armies surrounded Jerusalem, then the words of Jesus should have, and for many did, cause them to understand and then to act upon what he had told them to do. Let's go to the next section, verses 16 through 20. What to do when they see this sign? Verse 16, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to take anything out of his house. And let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. My paraphrase of that, when you see the army surrounding Jerusalem, run. Run. Get out of there. Don't take the time to go back home. Don't go come back down off the rooftop to go inside to pack your bags. You get out of there. Because that's the sign. The Roman army has surrounded you. Flee to the mountains. Flee to the mountains. Then Jesus adds four things that could make it more difficult to get away, to flee as rapidly as they needed to. Verse 19. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing baby in those days. Why? Because it'd be more difficult for them to travel, right? Verse 20, and pray that your flight may not be in winter or on the Sabbath. Why not? In winter, it'd be cold, it'd be more difficult to travel. On the Sabbath, there were these Jewish restrictions about what they could do on the Sabbath. If it were on the Sabbath, those Jews would be in a mindset of not doing any work. And also the gates of the city would be closed on the Sabbath day. And that would cause their fleeing to be more difficult. According to Eusebius in his ecclesiastical history, there were Christians who properly understood what Jesus was saying here. And when they saw the Roman army surrounding Jerusalem in that siege, they took their flight from Jerusalem. They fled across the Jordan River to Pella and were spared. They were spared. Why? Because they listened to Jesus, they saw the sign of which he predicted, and they acted upon his words. Jesus goes on to describe the nature of the coming event. Verse 21. For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, nor shall ever be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Jesus' prediction here is that this would be a horrible, horrible experience. Indeed, the horrors of the fall of Jerusalem are well documented. Those trapped in the city suffered terribly. Some historians suggest that as many as 1 million people endured terrible suffering and died in this onslaught. And Jesus next warns that some will come even during that time with some false hope. He says, therefore, if they say to you, look, he, speaking of the Messiah, he's in the desert, do not go out. Or look, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles, or perhaps we should say vultures, will be gathered together. He's talking about the destruction that would come. And as vultures are just flock to a carcass, a dead carcass, that's the imagery that Jesus is painting here. God is bringing judgment upon the Jews for their rejection of the Messiah. And in that judgment, Jerusalem, and especially the temple, would be destroyed. Jesus then discusses some striking events to follow. Verse 29. And I want to underscore the first word. Immediately. Immediately. Not after a while. Not after hundreds of years. But immediately. After the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened. The moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven. And the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. Then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. There's some fantastic language here, some intriguing language. The sun will be darkened. The moon won't give its light. The stars will fall from heaven. And as we search the scriptures, we see similar language being used, for example, by the Old Testament prophets. And in so many cases, when that kind of language is used, it signifies the fall of a nation or the end of an era. Similar language is used in Isaiah in reference to Babylon and Idumea, and in Ezekiel, similar language is used of Egypt, the fall of Egypt. And it's symbolic. And it's used to signify important events, again, that point to the fall of a nation or the end of an era. And I believe contextually that's what Jesus is alluding to. What is falling here, Jerusalem? What's the end? What era is ending? It's the end of the Jewish age. The temple was to be no more. No more could they look at the temple and say, as long as the temple is standing, we know we're God's chosen people. As long as the temple is standing, those sacrifices will continue. All that would have been done away. The sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And that sign seems to refer to the fulfillment of Jesus' prophecy. The tribes of the earth will mourn. The reaction of the Jews of the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple was no doubt mourning throughout the Jewish nation. They'll see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. That does sound like his second coming, doesn't it? But here it seems that it's in a figurative sense that he's coming in judgment upon the Jewish nation. Sometimes there's language to that end that it's not referring to the second coming of Jesus, but to the Lord coming in judgment as he is upon this Jewish nation. He will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet. They will gather together his elect from the four winds. Angels also means messengers. Could Jesus here be referring to the messengers that would take the gospel of Jesus Christ after the destruction of the temple, and would go out and share the good news of Jesus with the Jews and with the Gentiles? Christ's messengers would be spreading the message. Those who would answer the call and accept it would be his elect. But I want to remind you of two markers here. The word immediately. Immediately after this tribulation, these things will happen. And also the marker of his words in this generation. Look with me to verse 32. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that summer is near. Hopefully in a little while we'll start seeing that. Evidences of new life, of that spring is about to be sprung. And Jesus is saying, you look at a fig tree, you see when it puts forth leaves, you know that summer is drawing near. And he's using that fig tree as an illustration. So you also, when you see all these things he's been talking about, know that it is near. It's at the doors. But look at verse 34 again, crucial passage. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Some of them that he was speaking to that day would see all those things happen. And again, it points to 70 AD, about 40 years later, when that Roman army would come in and destroy Jerusalem and the temple. He closes this section with this affirmation, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. Now, verse 36, Jesus uses this phrase, but of that day and hour. Now we're outside that boundary of verse 34 in this generation. And it seems that from this point, verse 36 and following, even going into Matthew chapter 25, Jesus is now talking about the end of the world and his second coming. The disciples have assumed probably that when the temple would be destroyed, that would be the end of the world. But Jesus is saying, no, that's the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. That's the end of the Jewish age. But now he's going to talk about probably what was also on their minds, the end of the world when Jesus would return. Of that day and hour, when Jesus returns, when the world is destroyed, not even the angels of heaven know that, nor only my heavenly Father. Of that day, that singular, he's been referring to days in the plural in previous verses. But looking at the context of Matthew 24, beginning with verse 36 and into chapter 25, he's no longer speaking of a judgment upon Jerusalem for their rejection of the Messiah, but rather of the final judgment which shall come upon all men in that day. And if that is the case, notice what Jesus says about that day when he returns to judge the world. One thing that he says, no one knows when that will be. And another thing he teaches is that it will be totally unexpected. Verse 37. Someone asked me if I was going to preach about Noah tonight because of all this rain. And I responded to Miss Sandy, yes, I'm going to mention Noah, but it's not going to be about the rain so much. Notice what Jesus says, as the days of Noah were, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and did not know until the flood came and took them all away, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. In other words, people, when Jesus returns, people will have just been living as they've always lived. Marrying and giving in marriage, eating, drinking, living life. His coming will be unexpected. Verse 40. Two men will be in the field. One will be taken, the other left. Two women will be grinding at the mill. One will be taken and the other left. Now this text is used a whole bunch by those who believed in the doctrine of a rapture, that Jesus will secretly and quickly take his own. He will rapture them suddenly, take them to heaven before the great tribulation. The point here is that the moment is so sudden that there's no running, there's no getting out of it. And the chapter, the judgment scene which follows in the next chapter describes a separation. The sheep on the right hand, the goats on the left, the two have different destinies. And that seems to be the emphasis here. We should not use these descriptions to signify that those taken will go to heaven while those left will spend eternity on earth. Nor can this taking refer to a sudden transfer of Christians into heaven 7 years before Christ's coming, as some suggest. Again, he's emphasizing the suddenness of his coming. And here's a sign. Here's a sign, if you will. The final section, watch therefore. Verse 42. Watch therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. He gives an example, verse 43. But know this, that if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour that you do not expect. Here's a sign of the Lord's second coming. The sign is a thief in the night. When is a thief going to come and rob you? I'll never forget. I think we were on our way from church service in Marion, Alabama. And we drove back to our home, and we had a carport at the house where we lived. And we, after we got out of the car, we noticed something was missing. Sylvia's brand new bicycle had been stolen. They didn't take my beat up bicycle, but they took her brand new bicycle. It just left you with a sick feeling. Many of you have been there. Someone came and stole that. Had we known that thief was going to come, we could have put a chain around that bicycle. We could have put it into the shed or something, had we known. But we didn't know. The thief came unexpectedly. There's the sign. We don't know when Jesus is going to return. It could be at any moment. Watch, therefore, for you do not know that what hour your Lord is coming. Verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say to you, he will make him ruler over all his goods. But what if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards? The master of that servant will come on a day when he's not looking for him, and at an hour that he's not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The moral of Jesus' message is, servants don't know when their master is going to return. Therefore, servants need to be always busy doing their master's will. And if they're not, then they need to fear his coming, because he's going to come at a time that we do not know. Going into Matthew chapter 25, and just summarize some of the parables, The virgins do not know when the bridegroom will come. Matthew 25, 1 through 13. Servants do not know when they'll have to give an accounting. Matthew 25, parable of the talents. We don't know when the Lord will return to sit on his throne of judgment. Matthew 25, 31 through 46. What's the message? When it comes to the Lord's second coming, here's the sign. Watch, therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. It could be tonight. It could be tomorrow. We don't know. While Jesus was on earth, he didn't even know the time. There are really no signs except the thief in the night that he'll come unexpectedly. So we must be ready all the time. I heard one writer, or read one writer, suggest this phrase, stay ready until quitting time. Stay ready until quitting time. Be ready, because he could come at any time. And the way we are prepared for that is, number one, we've obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ, that we've become a Christian, that our sins have been washed away by his blood and in baptism as a penitent believer. And then we continue to be those faithful servants. We continue to serve him all of our days. May the Master find us serving when he comes. That's what he's looking for us to do, to continue to serve him. And one day, he will come and we'll be ready. If you're not ready, if you need to obey the gospel, if you need to come back as one who's wandered away, if you need the prayers of the church tonight, please let that be known as together we stand and sing.